Hi, Matt here. I wanted to remind you that for each episode, we provide English language learning support where we share useful information to help you develop your English skills. Check out these English language learning and other resources along with our newsletter and deep dive videos at fastersmarter.io under resources. Now a word from our sponsors. Their support covers the cost of production, allowing us to bring you this episode free of charge. One of the biggest frustrations in our modern work is that tools that are supposed to help us often end up only adding more complexity to our workload. You're in the middle of writing an email, preparing for a meeting, or reviewing a document, and suddenly you're jumping across tabs, searching for information, and trying to piece everything together while staying focused. Instead of pulling you into yet another app, Superhuman Go works where you already are, inside your browser, your inbox, your docs. So help is there right when you need it, without losing your place. As someone who has been a longtime user of both Grammarly and Superhuman Email, it's exciting to see these tools come together in a way that feels thoughtful. It handles more of the repetitive tasks in the background, so I can spend more time actually teaching, communicating, and connecting with people. If you're looking for a way to work more efficiently without adding more complexity, it's definitely worth exploring. Find out more at superhuman.com. The best way to connect and truly communicate is to be curious and respectful. My name is Matt Abrahams, and I teach strategic communication at Stanford Graduate School of Business. Welcome to Think Fast, Talk Smart, the podcast. Today, I'm really excited to speak with Fareed Zakaria. Fareed is the host of CNN's flagship international affairs program, Fareed Zakaria GPS. And he's a weekly columnist for the Washington Post. He specializes in translating complex geopolitical trends for a broad audience. His insightful book, Age of Revolutions, is out now in paperback. Welcome, Fareed. I have benefited so much from what you do on television and in your writing. Thanks so much for being here.
It's a pleasure to do this.
Shall we get started?
Absolutely.
You argue we're living in one of the most revolutionary periods in all of history. What specific forces are leading you to make this claim?
So if you look at the pace of change, particularly along the kind of key drivers that have tended to produce this kind of sense of society being upended, they tend to be technology in the first instance, almost always. You know, in my book, The Age of Revolutions, I talk about how starting with the Dutch and the invention of the kind of technology that allowed the Netherlands to become rich, you know, this was water management, then financial management. They created the first joint stock companies, the first stock exchange, then transportation equipment. They invent tall ships that can go around the world. It produces a huge set of revolutions. If you think about the information revolution, this really is the mother of all revolutions at some level, because you're almost replacing, or at least replacing in central importance, the material economy and supplanting it with a digital economy. And now with AI, that becomes even more true. The second is globalization, which is, we have seen an explosion of globalization on a scale in the last 30 or 40 years, on a scale like nothing we've seen before. To put it in simple context, globalization, you know, the rest of the world joining in the kind of Western open market system. 1950s and 60s, you had Japan joining, 80 million people, South Korea, 40 million people, Malaysia, maybe Singapore, Hong Kong, 5, 10 million. Between 1985 and 1995, roughly, China, India, most of Latin America, Indonesia, you're talking about 3.5-4 billion people joining the open world trading system. So that shock. But then the other one, which people don't think about enough, is we have gone through enormous cultural change in the last 40 years. Think about the role of immigrants in society, in Western societies. And the point I'm trying to make is that this is all happening at the same time. So when you put that all together, this does feel like the mother of all revolutions.
It's amazing how much has happened and how much has happened in a relatively short amount of time. In an age where we're in the midst of this information revolution and information is infinite and algorithms influence who sees and hears our messages, I'm curious to get your opinion. Do facts still matter, or has communication just become purely about identity and emotion?
It's become much more about identity and emotion because of the disaggregation of channels. I think the fundamental technological shift here, which is driving all this, is that there used to be centralized modes of communication. You know, think about radio as a one-to-many broadcast system. That's why in the old days when they'd have a coup, you would try to take over the presidential palace and you tried to take over the radio station because you wanted the source of political power and the source of information power. Then you went to the TV station and the presidential palace. Today, in a networked many-to-many broadcast system, there is no node to take over. There's no hierarchy of information. And in that situation, you are going to see a much greater degree of contested facts, contested narratives, and things like that. It's very disconcerting because it does mean, as you're suggesting, a kind of post-fact or post-truth environment. But it is where we are. And that means that you try hard to make your case as forcefully as you can. You can't rely on authority anymore to say, trust me, this is what happened. You're going to have to show the receipts.
You know, if you were to give people advice on how to talk smart in an environment where all the incentives are to speak loudly, what would you tell people to do?
The first thing you try to do, if you're trying to genuinely persuade people, as opposed to preach to the converted, which is what I would argue 90% of what passes for political discourse on television and even beyond television, social media for sure. For the first thing you've got to do is you've got to try and make the case as plainly, and I don't want to say unemotionally, but in a way that does not rely on demonizing somebody. You're trying to present the facts and you're trying to say, this is what the landscape looks like. Now, here's why I think what I do. So there's not a lot of ad hominem, there's not a lot of name calling, there's not a lot of screaming, because otherwise you're turning off a whole bunch of people. The second thing I think you have to do is you have to marshal the facts. When I say the receipts, you have to have real evidence, real data, so that people can see that you're coming to your conclusions from an honest place of analysis rather than a preconceived place of, this is my team and I'm rooting for my team. And the third, and this may sound like it's contradictory to the second, you have to be able to establish a connection, almost an emotional connection, with the person reading you, viewing you. And what I mean by that is you have to establish trust. And you can do it in different ways. One way is to not demean the other side. Do it in a way that says, look, I'm trying to be as honest and honorable as I can here. This is the situation as I see it. It seems to me we're going down a bad path, and here's why. So if you do those three things, you're likely to help. The way I think about it is lead somebody down a series of steps. Now, they may not get to the place you want them to get to, but at least they've gone down those steps and they've seen that you're trying to go down those steps honorably and reasonably and fairly, and then they may back away.
What I heard you say is that it starts with respect. You don't start with challenging and vitriol. You then provide the facts and then connect in a way that's genuine, authentic. And that's how you can foster understanding, which is different from agreement. I think that gets conflated a lot, where we see understanding and agreement being the same thing. As somebody who does both writing and video camera work, many people are finding themselves having to be on air more. I mean, much of our communication now is visual. If you're a leader in an organization, you have to have a camera presence. What have you noticed has helped you be successful in making that transition from writing and speaking in meetings into being on camera in a way that we all could benefit from some of the advice that you've learned?
What I am struck by is visual media is actually quite, it's the opposite of what most people think. It selects for a lot of things, but one of them is intelligence. Think about it this way. If you have an article that you're reading in a long magazine, say The Atlantic or The New York Review of Books or The Harvard Business Review, which is not quite that long, they can often meander. They can often be parenthetical. You can't do that on visual. People will stop. They'll click off. They'll switch the channel. They'll stop watching the YouTube video. You have to stay focused. You have to be linear. There has to be a narrative. You have to be saying something important. You can't be doing a lot of throat clearing. So that, I think I happen to be good at, because that's my way of thinking and talking anyway. And I tend to think that it's also that I am myself. I don't put on airs. I don't try to speak in a very fancy way. If you watch my show compared to, let's say you pull up a broadcast from Peter Jennings or Tom Brokaw, old anchors of 20 years ago, they would speak in these perfect clipped sentences with usually a low Midwestern baritone. And I don't talk like that. I talk the way I would talk to you normally. I also will have an occasional in there. I think that conveys to the viewer, this is a real human being and you're getting him talking the way he normally talks. I tend to think that's an advantage. It's maybe partly I say that because I don't think I could pull off this sustained staying in that anchorman mode, but I do think it's an advantage.
So I'm hearing concision and authenticity are really important. And the visual medium is not as forgiving. And these are skills that you can learn and you have to practice. And yet it's becoming more and more relevant and important. I want to tie in some of your work on revolutions to things that we think a lot about, which is entrepreneurship and disruption. Many of the revolutions you describe started with radical ideas that eventually became mainstream. Are there lessons we can learn that can help entrepreneurs and activists take their disruptive ideas and make them more generally acceptable?
I think that more than anything else, the ones that seem to succeed have two elements to them. One is luck. I will be totally honest with you. And I think anyone who doesn't admit this is just being silly. You know, you get the right time at the right place. The timing worked. Other factors came together to make something happen. But the second is a certain kind of determination, a certain sort of doggedness. You can't get too disheartened when you're trying to do something. And you have to be willing to ride the ups and downs. The way I think about it is so many of the people who I've seen who've been successful entrepreneurs, the company that worked was their third company. But they were determined to find something that works. And you adjust and say, okay, the market doesn't want this or the consumer doesn't want that. But you're going to do something. You're going to make it work in some way or the other.
So it's determination and taking advantage of the situation that is around you.
Maybe the way to think about luck is to recognize when fortune is favoring you and ride the wave. And that does take skill. And that does take, you need to be prepared, you need to work hard, and you need to ride the wave when you see the wave coming. And the other side to it is recognize when you're against the wave. I remember having this fascinating conversation with George Soros once. And he said, you and I do the same thing. We look at the world and try to analyze it. The difference is I put my money where my mouth is and you don't have to. And I said, okay, given that, what do you think are the differences in the way we approach it? And he said, I'll tell you, I think one of the principal differences, people who are intellectuals get very wedded to their ideas and they're very wedded to their theories. And they're slow to notice that the world is disconforming your idea. He said, if I see that the market is telling me I'm wrong, I will sometimes wait, but it's very expensive to wait. And so you really need to take in that feedback that the market is telling you you're wrong. And there are times when I have made a bet and the market is telling me I'm wrong, and I'll bet against myself twice as hard on the opposite side of that bet because I've realized that the market is right and I'm wrong. And intellectuals tend to be way too stubborn in holding on to their theories. I mean, you know this from being at a university, because people, in a way, get famous for their theory, right?
I think that's a really valuable point. In addition to tenacity and recognizing and being able to observe the patterns to decide what decisions to make, we need to be willing to let go and cut bait. And that's so hard. There's so many things that conspire against that. I'm going to be very curious to hear your thoughts on this. I and a fellow colleague at the GSB, Rachel Conrad, have become very concerned about how teens communicate and the challenges that they have. I'm sure you've seen the same decline that I have, that critical thinking, interpersonal communication among teens has really taken a hit. Do you have thoughts on what parents, teachers, communities can do to help adolescents communicate better?
I do. I hate to be cliched about this, but I do think that Jonathan Haidt is dead on when he talks about the effects of phones and social media, and it's the combination of the two. I think, and I have personal examples. I've seen this with my kids. And in one case, one of my kids put aside their smartphone for 2 years. They only had a flip phone. And it totally transformed the way in which they had the ability to connect and think and savor life almost. I think that the thing about a smartphone, which is like a supercomputer in your pocket, is it creates a certain kind of learned autism. What I mean by that, say when you and I were younger, we were in an awkward social situation. We're at a cocktail party, school mixer. You have to make your way around, right? Like you have to figure out what to do. You find somebody you can talk to. You look around sheepishly and hope that you catch somebody's eye. You're engaged in social interaction. Today, you know what happens. The minute somebody feels socially awkward, take out their phone, and they're on their phone, and they're now looking at Instagram, or they're connecting with some friends, but those are people they already know. You're not engaging in the hard work of social interaction, which is with the people you don't know, breaking the ice, finding a way in. Similarly, if you're listening to a lecture, the minute it gets boring for you, you take out your phone. You're not asking yourself, okay, is there something interesting here? Is there something I can connect with? Is there? No. So that's what I mean by the learned autism, right? Like you immediately retreat to yourself. And the supercomputer in your pocket allows you to retreat to yourself so quickly that you lose the muscles of doing those other things that you should be doing. I think that's most of it. I do not believe that kids today are stupider or they're good, they're hardworking, they have good morals, they have good ethics. But I think we have given them the biggest temptation you could ever imagine. Imagine if you and I were trying to study in the old days and you were given a machine on which you were told, you can watch every movie that has ever been made, every song that has ever been recorded, you know, here, or you could do your homework. You're giving them an impossible temptation. And so I just think the degree to which you can limit it is the best you can do.
Absolutely. I do agree that social media phones absolutely have implications. I do think adults in kids' lives can take action by role modeling good communication, walking through the decisions that we make as we communicate with others, just so that we can make sure that these skills are at least demonstrated and encouraged.
Yeah, I give you an example. In my family, we always sit down to dinner together, no phones at the table, and we always talk. Now, contrary to what a lot of people think, we don't talk about the world and international affairs and what's going on. We talk about just pretty mundane stuff. I think that's the more important, because I don't want them to have to feel like characters in my movie. It's about what happened in their day and what happened in the dog's life and things like that. And that, I think, just, it seems very simple, but it does seem to me that it's a fairly good force multiplier. And when I've talked to them, they often point out that when they talk to their friends, it's becoming uncommon for family to just sit together at dinner and have that meal together and sit down, talk, no phones. It's usually, let's be honest, it's 30 minutes, but it's a very useful 30 minutes.
Absolutely. And I love that you take the time to do that. And I'd love to be a fly on the wall on those conversations, because in my mind, I would imagine one thing and you're telling me it's something very different. We'll be right back to finish our conversation. But first, a quick word from one of our sponsors. Their support allows us to bring you this show free of charge. This episode is sponsored by Squarespace. One lesson I've learned from years of teaching communication is that expertise alone isn't enough. People need a way to discover your ideas, understand your work, and engage with what you have to offer. Effective communication doesn't end when the conversation is over. People need a place to learn more, explore your work, and stay connected with what you're creating. Squarespace makes it easy to build a professional online presence that reflects who you are. Their design tools make it simple to create a website that looks polished and professional without needing technical expertise. And if you create courses, premium content, or memberships, Squarespace gives you ways to offer that directly through your site. Head to squarespace.com/TFTS for a free trial. And when you're ready to launch, use code TFTS to save 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain. What do a tech CEO, a beauty brand founder, and a former president have in common? They've scaled bold ideas into movements and shared what they've learned on Masters of Scale. Recently, I joined host Jeff Berman to talk about communication, how to think on your feet, structure your ideas under pressure, and make your message land. We had such a practical, wide-ranging conversation that I wanted to share it with you here. So please take a listen. And then tune in every week to Masters of Scale to learn more about the strategies and mindsets behind extraordinary growth. Find Masters of Scale wherever you get your podcasts. And now, back to our conversation. Before we end, I like to ask three questions of everybody. One I create just for you, and then the other two are similar across all the episodes. Are you up for that?
True.
you have made your career, or part of your career, by asking tough, insightful questions of people. What makes for a good question? And do you have a go-to question that you like to ask people?
No, I think that's a mistake. I think that in general, you really should be listening to people and watching them. And that's, each person has a different button you want to press. I think the most important thing, and you've said it, is being genuinely curious and genuinely believing that everybody has a story to tell. Everybody has something to teach you. Everybody has a lesson you can learn. And I really do believe that. And if you have that kind of curiosity, it's fun to ask people questions. If I go to dinner parties and I find that like people have just asked me lots of questions, I leave disappointed because I know what I think. I'm only learning when I'm listening, not when I'm talking.
Absolutely. One of the mantras we learned from another guest we had on the show was, it's all about being interested and not interesting. And when you take that approach, it can be very helpful. I'm curious to know your answer to this. Who is a communicator that you admire and why?
Well, there are many, but let me give you one right now, just because it's top of mind. I think Mamdani, the new mayor of New York, is remarkable. He may be one of the best communicators I've seen because he's figured out the medium of the moment, you know, these short form videos. They're very expertly done. They're not, this is not amateur. Remember, his mother is one of the great directors of our age. You know, so they're done right. But then he brings to it a kind of intelligence, imagination, and authenticity. So the imagination is, if, I don't know if you remember, he's advocating for rent freezes, right? So he jumps into the Long Island Sound in February with freezing waters in his full suit. And he comes out saying something about how he's freezing and how he wants to freeze the rents. That's the imagination, to get your attention to. That is really very compelling, that mixture of intelligence, imagination, knowing the medium and being authentic. I should say, I find many of his ideas deeply troubling, and I don't agree with the substance of the policies, but I am irresistibly drawn to the power of his communication skills.
Isn't it interesting how somebody can appreciate and understand the new way of communicating, new technologies, and still bring that authenticity, intelligence to take advantage of it? Thank you for sharing that. Final question for you. What are the first three ingredients that go into a successful communication recipe?
I would start with authenticity, because I think that's where you get the trust. Some say, you know, clarity and, you know, kind of concision. And then the final one is probably that leap of imagination that allows you to be a little different, that allows you to do something arresting. That gets you into the top tier, I think.
So it's about authenticity, clarity and concision, and creativity and imagination. And I think when you combine that recipe together, you get great communication. And certainly you are a good example of putting those together. I appreciate all of the ideas and best practices you have shared. And I really appreciate the intelligent conversation that you role model for all of us. Thank you for your time and best of luck on your paperback of Age of Resolutions.
Thank you so much. This is so much fun. I actually learned a lot while doing it.
Thank you for joining us for another episode of Think Fast, Talk Smart, the podcast. To learn more about managing complex issues in communication, please listen in to episode 161 with Jen Psaki. This episode was produced by Catherine Reed, Ryan Campos, and me, Matt Abrahams. Our music is from Floyd Wonder, with special thanks to the Podium Podcast Company. Please find us on YouTube and wherever you get your podcasts. Be sure to subscribe and rate us. Also, follow us on LinkedIn, TikTok, and Instagram. And check out fastersmarter.io for deep dive videos, English language learning content, and our newsletter. Please consider joining our Think Fast, Talk Smart learning community at fastersmarter.io/learning. You'll find video lessons, learning quests, decision boards, an AI coach, and book club opportunities. Again, that's fastersmarter.io/learning to become part of our Think Fast, Talk Smart learning community.
Before we wrap up, I just want to say thank you for listening. It really means a lot to hear how people all over the world are using these ideas in their own lives. It inspires me and the whole team that brings you this show. If you want more episodes and resources, feel free to follow, subscribe, and explore past conversations. We're grateful for your support of Think Fast, Talk Smart.